Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Giant Conversations, episode number 8, with me, Oliver Tillman, and Tommy. Hi, Tommy.
Hi, Oliver. How are you?
Good. Good. It's a nice afternoon. It's actually getting sunny. Oh, yes. It was sunny a second ago. Now it's not, but we're in Germany, so that's normal. But let's not really go down the path of the weather, even though it hints directly at our first subject. But I think we first cue our jingle.
That sounds good to me. You know, the note on the weather, which one of the first sentences that I learned in Germany was April, April, er weiß nicht, was will. And I thought that was one of the funniest sayings, because I didn't realize in Germany at the time that when you can put a declination of calling something a man or a woman, and it means that the weather in April is a he. And I was like, oh, I get it. This is a very easy language to understand.
Yeah, but for that, I have some wonderful, like, I know we're starting differently now, but this is fun.
Sure.
International company, and we're going to nomads directly, like how languages are different. I have a translation thing here where they put the English sentences so that the correct German saying comes out. My English is not the yellow from the egg, but it goes.
Oh, gosh.
Is a German saying. Mein Englisch ist nicht das Gelbe vom Ei, aber es geht. It, like, my English is not the best, but it's okay. So, and you go me on the cookie.
Yeah, yeah. Du gehst auf meinen Keks. My wife says that to me all the time.
Exactly. So that's so perfect. I only understand train station.
Yeah, German idioms are great.
This makes no sense.
Just one last quick thing. I've always wanted to have a saying that I can tell people that states my German is not that good, and I don't want to say I had been saying. Entschuldigung, aber diese Sprache ist wirklich schwierig für mich. And when you translate it to English, it just sounds sad. It's like, oh, I'm sorry. It's a difficult language. So I asked some friends, and they said, oh, I've got one for you. You can just say, ja, aber diese Sprache ist doch jeck.
Very good.
I use it all the time.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, yes. You are in Cologne, so that works, but it's great.
Yeah, it does work here.
Love it. So let's go directly in the first news item.
Yes.
Because today we have, by the way, everybody, we have some great guests lined up. They're coming and it'll be fun. And today we're like Tommy and me are just talking. So if you want to relax, lay down on the couch, listen to our voice. We will count to five and then you, no, well, never mind. and we have some fun topics to talk about. So first one is numbers on digital nomads.
Yes.
I mean, we are a remote company, so that kind of clicks.
And I was thinking while I was scrolling through some of these percentages and numbers, we have had quite a few digital nomads in our company. Yulia is a digital nomad. Marat just spent 6 months out nomading, and so did Václav. He was a digital nomad before COVID. And then he settled down, bought himself a house, and is working on that the whole time. But Dr. Anna is still a digital nomad. She is no longer working at Giant Swarm, but she has the van life. And some of the stats I thought were pretty interesting. First, they say the definition of digital nomad is to live in a country for 3 months and then move on. Now, obviously, that's because of visa reasons
and taxes,
all kinds of things.
I think if you don't live anywhere for more than 6 months, you kind of stop paying taxes.
Right. Yeah, I guess.
Unless you're American, I think. And no matter where you live, you always pay taxes.
Yeah, I do. Well, I always have to file taxes. That doesn't mean I always have to pay them. There's not taxes to pay based on a grant, but I do have to file them, which is a real pain, filing German and American taxes. They also say that 90% are saying that they're going to stick with being nomads. Now, that is
Until they get married and have kids.
Exactly. Thank you. The average age is between the ages of 23 and 44. But honestly, when talking to digital nomads, you always get really excited. Oh, where are you going to be next? Oh, I'm going to Portugal and then I'm going to Bali. But they do have a lot of problems with being lonely or missing family. When COVID struck, we had three or four people who were stuck in their hotels. Even Heather was stuck down in South Africa.
Yeah.
She couldn't get back. Yulia was also stuck. And so I think there's a lot of cons to it. And all the cons were a third of them, like 30 some odd percent. There were had actual numbers behind them. But they say by 2035, we'll have about a billion digital nomads.
I 180,000% do not buy that. That's a bullshit stat. I mean, seriously, we have 8 billion people. I mean, do we have more homeless people? And that's why we call them digital nomads,
sure,
because they
sure.
don't have a place to live. But I mean, so a billion, does. Come on. No. In 2020, 10.9 million digital nomads were recorded compared to 7.3 million in 2019. If we keep up that growth, that's like 30% growth, 2020. I don't think we end up at 1 billion.
No, that's a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, maybe they just calculated. But okay, it will be a more prevalent lifestyle. I fully agree with that. You know?
Yeah. As long as you can handle it. I mean, it's not my thing.
What else is there interesting in terms of stats?
They said that a lot of it happened because of the pandemic, and that the increase was 131% from 2019 to 2022.
Okay.
And average age, actually, of all of the 170 plus stats, those were really the ones that I latched onto. They do have lists of countries that people least like going to and countries that people most like going to, but nothing really stood out because the percentages were so low. It's like 5% like to go to Portugal. That's number one. It's like, okay, great.
U.S. citizens, they're now 26 million. So it's really growing, yes, but okay. Yeah, it will be a more prevalent lifestyle. I mean, we have that at Giant Swarm and obviously at the remote company and more companies being remote. And the question is if you say people are moving about 3 months a year or something, that then I would start buying it, you know? Like you have a home, but you move around a lot and you extend your holiday to a certain extent and stay there and work there. That,
right.
You know, that I am buying or doing it from time to time or doing it after studies or during studies because you're studying remotely. So, yeah, fine. 51% identify as Democrats, 24 Republicans, and 23 declare themselves as independents. But I think that's pretty much probably the age gap. Like if you ask in the age, it's probably similar.
Those are also really American stats. I mean, Those are the kind of things that are important to somebody who's reading this in the US, what their political affiliation is. Don't want to bring up all the politics and things, but if you were to look at my personal views in the United States, I'm what we would call a bleeding heart liberal, like the real liberal kind of guy. Over in here in Germany, I would consider myself a Republican because the politics, the rights for the people are just that much more that I would find myself being more on a Republican point of view, where in the US I am as liberal as they come. Like it's not even a conversation. People hate to talk to me.
That's one of the other interesting ones I found is like, okay, religion is on the downturn. I mean, 8% are Christians, 3% Buddhists, 2% believe in astrology, like one quarter of the Christians, like 2% adhere to Islam, 2% Judaism, and it goes downhill from there. So like the total believing in anything is like 14-15%. And then it stops.
Yeah.
So yeah, but okay, let's stop on the nomadism and go to Kubernetes stuff. And there actually, and I looked it up, we have Kubernetes version 1.30 out, mm-hmm. and it's called Ububernetes.
Ububernetes,
and it might mm-hmm. be confusing for some, and it was confusing for Tommy, if I understand correctly,
yes,
why there's suddenly
definitely.
A cat in the box.
I have an opinion on this. You know, I do. Having worked in communications for my entire career, having started off working at a newspaper, it's just about the most untechnologically advanced kind of job you can have, working in marketing at a newspaper. But all the way through my career, even having worked for tech companies and now with Giant Swarm, working in Kubernetes, nowhere I would ever work would have or even use a product that would have just a cat coming out of a box. It even has hearts for eyes, because people just wouldn't take it seriously. And they would sit around a table and say, hey, I drafted up this logo. And they'd be like, are you kidding me? Whereas in our ecosystem, it was probably, you know, oh, let's put that on a shirt. Let's get a hat. Oh my gosh, I love everything about this. Unanimously, this is what we're going with. And partially, this is, yeah.
I think that's the community. And I can actually explain where it's coming from.
Yeah, please.
Because I looked it up. The thing is, the uvu is an mm-hmm. emoji. It's a cute face, used to express warm, happy, affectionate feelings, you know, like also surprise and excitement. And that's what they tried to do, like cuteness and happiness, you know, because this community is so weird to a certain extent and wonderful and welcoming and diverse and happy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one thing everybody talks about at KubeCons and whatnot is we're having great parties and great fun together and so on and so forth. So, and I think as that, from a marketing standpoint, I like them playing with it.
I'm all about it. I'm just surprised, I guess. I just need to know, now I know the level of how important cuteness is into a product that I consider very, very, very serious, that runs massive infrastructures at a global yeah. level.
And I just think that trying to keep the seriousness while being big business, because for big business, we have another link in the show notes. There's a wonderful tweet by Davanum Srinivas. Sorry for butchering your name. And he used SCC, which is a tool to make complexity calculations and Kokomo estimates, like code counter, and like figure out like how expensive was that thing to build. And he ran that thing on Kubernetes. I think he added a few things. Like, for example, I think he added that like the scheduling effort is close to 10 years now, because we're closely nearing the 10 years. I don't know. I assume he took the Kubernetes 1.0 announcement or something, which was in 2015, or like the whatever he says, 107.16 months is the effort put into this platform. Mm-hmm. And then he estimates it would have taken, or has taken, 184.06 people that entire more or less 10 years or 9 years and a bit, which end up costing $220 million as an open source project that has just appeared out there, and nobody really gets a salary from Kubernetes itself, or almost nobody. And they're all paid by somebody else. And like, it always cost a quarter of a million. And what I liked most, thank you, Twitter. Sometimes you're good for stuff. Other chat tool if you don't like Twitter. We could have bought a Boeing Dreamliner, but only one, for the same price. The Salesforce Tower in Indianapolis. And we could have made Avengers Age of Ultron. You know, that's like similar. But we built an amazing community on the side, and people using Kubernetes made a lot more money than that. Would be a good question. Like, I don't know how much revenue Avengers Age of Ultron made, and if Kubernetes is more profitable, I would say it's way more profitable than Avengers Age of Ultron. So successful open source project, and we have more subjects on open source at later dates. Perfect example of something really working.
Yeah.
And I assume there's actually more effort in this than this, but I mean, it's already a good mix. I like it.
What I thought was really cool about what he's put in here, you've got the language, the files, the lines, comments, the code. And as I was going through, of course, not being in DevOps or an engineer myself, I'm trying to pick apart and find out where I can be a part of this in any way possible. And I did find a place in here. So under complexity, both JSON and YAML, now this is under a complexity of a zero.
Mm-hmm. That you could do.
That, well.
Complexity zero, you think you could do.
Well, Markdown is just underneath that. And I know Markdown.
Yeah, you can do documentation.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I can do documentation. Yes, sure.
That's what I mean.
I do. But yeah. So I was thinking, wow, I guess JSON and YAML must be really that easy. Obviously, I'm kidding.
Yeah. Totally easy. Like everybody loves YAML. Like we have this scream channel, like where people can scream, and if they're annoyed, and YAML comes up. Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. All the time. YAML and Helm.
YAML and Helm. So, that's that. And while we're at the open source part, we can jump right on to HashiCorp. Because remember, some time ago, we talked about HashiCorp and HashiCorp like changing the license to business source license. Then OpenTofu coming out. And now HashiCorp has sued OpenTofu for actually taking code under the business source license. And we linked the news article about that. And obviously OpenTofu said, okay, people will respond. And they have recently responded. We put the answer in there. And they really have like PDFs comparing the code and so on and so forth. And they say, I'm very sorry that we were working on similar things, but we obviously copied the original old license stuff and then just by chance worked on similar things and did similar implementations. But in the end, like it's totally separate. So we're fine. But it really shows again, like HashiCorp doesn't like this happening. And we then recently found out, and one of our colleagues, Marcus, actually predicted that some weeks ago, that there are rumors out there that IBM will be buying HashiCorp. So I'm pretty sure in the due diligence that is happening, they said, okay, you need to kill this OpenTofu thing. Sure. Otherwise, your price drops by 30%. Interesting. But that, like, really, we need to have more detailed conversations about stuff like that because it's so amazing for me that you can build an amazing company in HashiCorp. You can have it hugely profitable. They're making a profit. It's not like they're dying. They're just not making enough of a profit, it seems, for this world win. And now they're being bought by IBM, and now they need to sue the things that forked their code, which is the entire reason of them existing to a certain extent. At the same time, you have something like Kubernetes that doesn't belong to anybody, really thriving, and loads and loads of money being pushed into it. Just factor in all the stuff that is happening on top of Kubernetes with entire companies like running stuff inside Kubernetes and tools inside Kubernetes and us running a managed platform. And so it's really like it's a really interesting subject.
I'm just amazed that we opened up this conversation just before KubeCon and asked that question, which we'll be talking to Courtney Nickerson in 2 weeks. Specifically about this, but how it just keeps unfolding. I mean, there are every week there's a new story or news story about companies either getting closed or changing their licensing, now being bought. Like you said, it's a real whirlwind right now with open source.
Yeah, and but we actually had Puya on an interview for the news stack with Alex Williams, right, around Flux. So take a look at that. And I am actually, like, the original company is no longer there. But at the moment, I'd gather Flux is in a better state now than it was before, to a certain extent. Like, it's in a much better community, a much bigger community, mm-hmm, because people didn't want to see it go. Probably they didn't feel like they needed to step up that much when it was still a company, in brackets. Right. And now it's a really gigantic community and with really powerful companies behind it. So I'm really like, good interview. Take a look. Record it at KubeCon. You need to manage the background noise. But other than that, like, they didn't have microphones in people's faces like we did.
Right.
But really take a look. We love Flux.
So the next bit, two weeks ago, Giant Swarm and Resync were together here in Cologne and with Timo and Michel Müller and
Michael Resnick. Wasn't there. Pini was there.
This was the one with Pini then. Okay. And I think this is cool. Now, Pini is really able to pull all kinds of great stats. And one of them that stood out to me here is that by 2025, almost 12,000 of the largest EU companies are going to have to report their greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, how are they going to go about doing that? Are they going to be able to pull stats from different places?
And there are companies being born around that, like Resync.
I mean. So,
and the question, like, I agree that it needs to happen. There's lots of stuff that needs to happen, but the question is, what are the fines? Are there fines already? What are the fines? How deep does it have to go? How much estimation will go on there? I think it's a good direction in general. It'll be interesting to see how, like, cost-saving tools in Kubernetes and attribution tools in Kubernetes will evolve, how you attribute that to different teams, how you also look at coding style and stuff, how you look at how that is optimized, how you build software the right way to save money and CO2 and less servers and take the better servers and so on and so forth. So I think it's the right direction. But, I mean, this has been clear for some years that this is going to happen. Right. And I think some people are preparing, and some are preparing more than others. Obviously, some are pushing out more CO2 than others. I still have to say, in the talks we're having, I don't hear people getting afraid. You know, they're still, we'll manage somehow.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a benchmark. That's all we need to have at first, as a benchmark, and say, okay, if this company is emitting this much CO2 and you're a similar company with similar infrastructure, to be able to benchmark and say, yeah, but you could be this low, or look how high everybody else is, you can be the leader.
Yeah, and I think that's the effect that will happen,
right,
is that it will get more attention. I think for 2025, they'll hire KPMG, McKinsey, whatever, and just do a report. They'll just go, here are 20 interns, go figure it out. I don't think that will be, but the tools will develop that will make it easier and more correct, because once they start having it, they want to see how they lower it, because they, as you say, company A will see that company B is a lot lower, and then, you know, then it gets interesting.
Yeah. And you can lower your cost by millions.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and that will probably happen. So, that's cool. But actually, adjacent to that, Puppet did a state of DevOps report. Automation and so on and so forth. That's why I say it's adjacent. You need to automate the CO2 part two to help you, like, build the right tools and so on and so forth. And obviously, like, I mean, I like in general these reports coming out, and it's always interesting to glean a few things. I partly find it interesting because I don't necessarily see it in real life. So I'm wondering if, like, I would have to go through the questions to really figure out how that was gotten out, because security is now built into most platform engineering efforts from the start. At the same time, we know that, like, when the change from pod security policies to pod security standards happened, like 20% of the clusters out there had pod security policies. So not baked in from the start. Hmm. Yes, I think it's happening, but let's see how security continues, and getting teams to be security aware and upgrade aware will be interesting. So that I don't fully know. I also think, like, we really need to, like, how real DevOps are they doing? And then obviously you have the platform teams that are there. And most of these platforms are still old. Even though they now might not, they say 70% said their platforms are 3 years old. This continuous improvement and so on and so forth that we're working on with customers is an effort, mm-hmm. and costs money and costs mindshare, and you need to continuously evolving. Our platform is way different today than it was 3 years ago, and way more efficient and way more helpful and way more secure and way more monitored and way more capable of doing things, and way more stable, as it always gets more stable through the things we learn by doing DevOps on the platform side of things. So that I really agree. And I love their response that you need a product manager on the platform team. And 52% said you need to, 21% said it's nice to have. We have we have product managers in every part of the platform, because it's a product as anything else.
Right.
You know, it's a platform to build platforms and to build and so on. So you need a platform strategy. And that's not, oh, we're doing Kubernetes, let's install it and then see what happens. Like, there needs to be a product vision behind it. So I really suggest, like, if you have access to it, go read it. It has some interesting insights. See where you fit, where you don't fit, where you can learn, where you can change. Gladly hit us up for our opinion. I mean, that's interesting. And as the last one, the platform helps to get in line with regulatory compliance. Mm-hmm. There I agree, in the sense that with now our entire GitOps approach that we talked about, like, last Giant Conversations number 7 with Timo, you can bake that right into the platform. So whenever somebody does something in the platform, you know the state of the code and you know the state of the compliance, and you can really make sure you're compliant to whatever you defined at the beginning. Because otherwise, what we see a lot, that there are 40, 50, 60 different flavors of Kubernetes inside the company, and that's a hellhole from a compliancy standpoint. So while it's nice that you say it's DevOps and every team does their infrastructure themselves, yes, the question is what the infrastructure is. Is it the AWS API or is it the Kubernetes API? And in our opinion, if you want it to be Kubernetes, then it needs to be the Kubernetes API, and you need a platform team with a product vision and a compliance vision and so on and so forth behind that for the entire thing behind the Kubernetes API. And you can't just say everybody does it themselves. Not everybody will run their own servers either. Not everybody will run their own storage. Not everyone will run their own source control. Not everyone will run their own AI system and so on and so forth. You need to normalize at certain steps that make sense where there's a good API to talk to. And there, Kubernetes is just the right API, but I need to stop.
Like, yeah, preach it, Oliver.
Start sounding like a sales pitch. I don't want to do that. But I really like the report. So that's a good one. So let's end on a more crazy thing. You found a crazy tweet.
I did. So I was looking up a couple of the different talks that we've given over the past several weeks to see what kind of news we can update everybody on, and found one from Boston Dynamics. Now, I was going to say found a fun one from Boston Dynamics, but that's a bit of an oxymoron because everything that comes out of Boston Dynamics is scary as hell. And this this is no exception. So we've got a link in our show notes about the all new Atlas. And it's 39 seconds, and it just shows the robot standing up, but of course not in a way that you would ever stand up, but in a way that a Boston Dynamics robot would stand up. So it's ultra creepy. It's exorcist-like. And I was scrolling through the comments because I know that people on YouTube and their comments are going to be far more clever than I am, especially if 3,000 people have liked it. And one fella said, "This is when I realized that not having 360-degree joints as a human is so frustrating." So just another Boston Dynamics robot coming out and or has come out, and it's wild. Yeah, give it a look.
Yeah, it's crazy how it stands up and moves around and things like, yeah.
No good.
Yeah. And that's a good ending. Life is crazy. Where 1 billion of us will be nomads. Okay, in 10 years.
Sure.
1 billion of us. So prepare to never see your kids again. Just statistically, they will be the ones that will be nomads and will be gone forever and nowhere to be found. So and sad. You will always have to have a tracker on them. And sustainability will get more tracked, and that's cool. And open source will go crazy. And DevOps will rule the world, and robots will take all our jobs. All right.
All right.
Thank God we didn't talk about AI.
No, not this time around. Okay, let's go with it. So listen, like, subscribe. We've got a new landing page out that will offer all of those things for you to be able to do.